From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
From the outskirts of Minneapolis, it's That's the Thing, the film podcast where twin critics talk about, well, what else? Films. After a long hiatus, it's great to be back. My name is Nick Cooey. Join with me, as always, is my co-host, Alex Cooey. And we are recording this now after our previous episode in the summer. We are very well in the midst of fall. How are you keeping warm in this Minnesota fall, Alex?
Well, you should know, since we share the same house.
It's a rhetorical question, Alex.
I kid. It's great to be back, but... you know, it's a bit chilly and nippy here, but I'm doing fine, you know, just keeping myself warm, you know, dressed up in warm clothing, having a nice hot cup of tea or hot cocoa. I'm doing fine, all things considered. How are you?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm doing well, Alex, and I think that just really paints a very cozy picture of us settling down for this holiday season to talk about something which has really absolutely nothing to do with the holidays. But it does have something to do with today, because we are recording this episode on November the 22nd, and it is, of course, the anniversary of the JFK assassination. And this is one of those things where we were not really planning on this, but it ended up being one of those things that just happened, that we decided that we were going to do an episode in our Smells Like Twin Critics miniseries on Oliver Stone's controversial Academy Award-winning film, JFK. Because you were the one who actually approached me with this.
Yeah, I was going to say, although we did not plan to record it on the exact anniversary of Kennedy's assassination 58 years ago to the date, I was adamant in us talking about this film, and I wanted to discuss about it because, as you alluded to, it was probably more than any other American film that came out that year, it was the most controversial to come out of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And it was like one that had a lot of publicity coming around. It had like at the time, a very popular, well-regarded director who had won 2 Oscars. It had a big name Hollywood cast, which we might go into detail later. It had all this publicity going into it. And when it did come out, it was, there was a lot of controversy surrounding the authenticity of the facts it was exploring and like the source material that it was based off of. But still, in spite of all that, it was praised by some critics, with Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert actually putting it very high in their top 10 lists of the best films of that year, with Roger Ebert placing at number 1. Mm-hmm. And you said it received like 8 Oscar nominations and would go on to win 2.
Right. And it is a topic as well that Oliver Stone just revisited this year with his documentary JFK Through the Looking Glass, which was, or JFK. Okay, Revisited Through the Looking Glass, I should say, which was screened out of competition at the Cannes Film Festival this year. So it's something it's even though 30 years have passed, it is a longstanding preoccupation for that filmmaker. And certainly the whole mythos around JFK's assassination has been a lingering preoccupation on the collective consciousness of American society. And it's one that, for better or for worse, it still has impacted the way that I would say a lot of people forge a sense of their own relationship with their government. But I might be putting the cart before the horse here, because this is a complex topic for a movie, let alone a podcast. And I'm not quite sure where we should start. But if you could, Alex, maybe I guess the way to start is, when did you first see JFK? Because this is not your first time watching the film.
No, it wasn't. I had actually seen this before. And I think I want to say it was about 5 years ago or so, 4 or 5 years ago, was when I first saw it. And it was one of those films I'd heard about, of course, for a while because of its notoriety. I remember actually when we used to be subscribed to Entertainment Weekly, and there was a summer 2006 issue. I don't know if you remember this, but they had that issue was like with them listing the top 25 most controversial movies of all time. And one of the films listed was JFK, of course. Mm-hmm. So then one day I decided just to watch it on HBO. I think HBO Go used to be called. This was before HBO Max, mm-hmm. for those who recall. And I did think that it was interesting to finally get around to watching it. And also being aware, because even though I had not seen it until when I was an adult, but I was familiar with like parodies of the film through popular culture. Like the first thing I can recall of being aware of the parody was in the actually 10 years after JFK's release with the Ben Stiller comedy Zoolander.
Dallas, Texas, 1963. Kennedy had just put a trade embargo on Cuba, ostensibly halting the shipment of Cuban-manufactured Sansibel slacks, an incredibly popular item at the time.
Lee Harvey Oswald is not a male model.
You're goddamn right he wasn't, but those two lookers who capped Kennedy from the grassy knoll sure as shit were.
Well, it's interesting that you kind of bring that up because, yeah, that was also kind of the first time I remember sort of being somewhat aware of that, of the film of JFK. I mean, I think as a youth, you know, for two people who actually were born in 1991, we were separated from the generation that was alive when JFK was assassinated. Like, our mom's generation can very vividly remember that day. And in terms of just sort of what was happening, even that weekend, in terms of just the rapid speed at which events unfolded with the president's assassination, the apprehension of the suspect, Lee Harvey Oswald, his assassination at the hands of Jack Ruby, and then JFK's funeral on Monday. And, I mean, and that's, of course, a lot of the images from those 3 to 4 days have been heavily mythologized and perpetuated throughout our iconography. Constantly in so many different specials. I mean, it's so interwoven within the fabric of this national narrative about the mid-20th century for America. And of course, there's the whole notion about what would have happened had John F. Kennedy lived. And that was because, of course, he was only one of a series of high-profile assassinations that were taking place in the United States that decade, because we saw not long after his assassination, Malcolm X's killing in 1965, and then Martin Luther King Jr.'s in 68, and not long after him, John's brother Robert.
Yeah, exactly. And I also feel like a film like JFK was able to be made for a variety of different factors. One of them, of course, has to be, you know, with the release of the Warren Commission, which was very controversial upon its release, because a lot of the facts and the findings that were placed out in this commission in the 888-page report were put into question by lots of people, including, of course, the lone bullet theory, or some people sort of derided it as the magic bullet theory.
Right.
And then, of course, later, you know, with the 70s, there came the leaking of all these papers on how our intelligence agencies who had worked, you know, secretly within this country, as well as overseas, like from the media burglary break-in of the FBI office, which first introduced people to COINTELPRO, to Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, to then, of course, the leak of the CIA papers, which really disclosed, like, how influential they were in overthrowing governments, foreign governments.
And then their complicity in the death of other figures here on our own soil, like Fred Hampton, famous, which was, of course, dramatized just with last year's Judas and the Black Messiah.
Yeah, exactly. So, and it's and there were like movies being made in the 70s which reflected that sense of like paranoia and suspicion of the government, with movies like Alan J. Pakula had done that with Clute and with All the President's Men, which is a dramatization of the Watergate scandal.
Right, right. I mean, it's really interesting that you say that, because the spirit of paranoia and mistrust between the American people and the shadowy specter of government was palpable in a lot of the new Hollywood of the 70s. And even though a lot of these films didn't explicitly, like, of course, as you just singled out, All the President's Men is based off a real life case, a high profile case, but a lot of these films obliquely commented on more the feeling rather than actual historical events. I mean, for example, we're thinking about a movie like The Conversation, which was about surveillance and this sort of omnipotent specter that's hanging over any character or any person operating within American society. And then, of course, that only developed even further as the decade went on and as more information about the JFK case was released. I mean, most notoriously, perhaps, the release of the Zapruder home movie, which was, of course, the famous film that was shot by Abraham Zapruder of the president's death, which gave credence to the exact timing in terms of the space of the shots that hit the president and Governor Connally in that motorcade as they were going through Dallas. And that did even that then threw into question about, oh, is it possible if Oswald could have reloaded the weapon that quickly to fire those different shots? Is the wound that JFK has, is that from the front or the behind? Because of course the book depository was behind him as they were driving along, but are the wounds maybe come from in front? And if so, then were there multiple shooters? And is that the basis for a conspiracy? And it's kind of interesting that we were talking a while ago actually about Brian De Palma's Blowout very briefly, but Blowout is certainly a kind of film that I think couldn't have been made without the cultural impact of something like the JFK assassination and the Zapruder film, and the way that cinema intersects with trying to uncover the truth and the slippery nature of what truth is and how that intersects, of course, with power.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. But, of course, I think it also wouldn't have been able to come out without, of course, another key component and somebody who, as you said, had very personal ties to this whole, to the JFK assassination. Now it's Oliver Stone. Mm-hmm. And, to give context, I think a lot of people know who Oliver Stone is, and some may be aware that, of course, when he was a young man, he actually served in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And this is before he decided to become a filmmaker, and he went to film school and actually... I believe he attended a course that in which he was taught by Martin Scorsese. Mm-hmm. But then he tried making some movie. He worked as a screenwriter. He actually won an Oscar for co-writing Midnight Express, which was another controversial film that talked about real-life prison, but like its authenticity was put into question. Mm-hmm. And he made wrote some notable screenplays like Scarface.
And he also directed some films in the mid-80s that garnered attention, like Salvador with James Woods, and then of course not long after that, his big Oscar-winning Vietnam epic, Platoon.
Yes, and that was when he got his big break, because he tried directing before with like The Hand in 81 with Michael Caine, but that wasn't hit. But yeah, it was until 86 when the 1-2 punch of Salvador and Platoon came out. Then people started getting attention to him, and then he followed it up with Wall Street, and then Talk Radio, and then he won his second Oscar with the Born on the 4th of July, which was the Tom Cruise vehicle based on the life of another Vietnam veteran, Ron Kovic.
And that was the second in his so-called Vietnam trilogy as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Yeah, and so at this point in his career, Stone was certainly making a name for himself as something of a provocateur, a little bit, or at least in terms of making films which were, in many respects, talking about the fallout of American imperialism, at least through warfare, But he hadn't made something that was about the domestic impact on quite the level of something like JFK.
I mean, Born on the 4th of July explores, I've seen that film, and it does sort of explore, the fallout of Ron Kovic, when he's trying to get back into domestic life, but the horrible things he's witnessed and experienced leave him shaken, and he just cannot, get back to the way things were.
Right, right. But what I'm saying is, that was, still straddling the line between, what life over there is versus life back home. Mm-hmm. And JFK, though, was about life at home. And that's that does mark something of a departure point for Stone. And Stone himself, if I'm not mistaken, was saying that JFK was a significant departure point for his own stature and his own style as a filmmaker.
Yes, it was. He said it really was. So in terms of his experimentations with this movie, not just with the writing, but also with the editing and how he went about working with the editing. I actually had two editors on this film. One of them was Pietro Scalia, who would later go on to edit a lot of Ridley Scott films. And the other editor was a man named Joe Hushing, who I believe was known for doing commercials. Mm. So, and it's like taking that, it's like taking someone with that approach to make what was really kind of, I guess, for Hollywood at the time, a radical kind of form of editing, because there's a lot of quick, rapid sort of cuts and showing flashbacks and cutting to the present, showing different vantage points and perspectives. And what was interesting about JFK, the development was, I talked about the kinds of movies that inspired him of his approach to telling the story. Mm-hmm. And they included from Akira Kurosawa's Rashomon, of course, to a famous Greek film called Z.
Well, you're talking about Costa Gavras, who, of course, was, I mean, he had been making films for several decades, and he was, in a lot of respects, before Oliver Stone, before several other American filmmakers were trying to write the coattails of political, or try to sort of tap into political filmmaking, Costa Gavras was one of the most formidable international filmmakers, I mean, he still is in many respects, to really explore and dissect the thorniness of politics. And Z is certainly a classic. It was it had a huge impact in 1969 when that came out, and that led the way for him to make other films that were also successful abroad internationally, like 1982's Missing with Jack Lemmon and Sissy Spacek, both of whom end up actually being cast members of Stone's JFK.
Yeah, that's right. It's funny because I didn't think of it that way, but you're absolutely right. And yeah, when you look at the cast of JFK, I do feel like for a Hollywood film of that year, I think even more so than even something like Lawrence Kasdan's Grand Canyon, it's got quite a list of who's who in this cast. You have, of course, Kevin Costner in the lead, and I think he was honestly at sort of the peak of his career.
Well, because he had just won. His Dances with Wolves was a huge success commercially and critically, just only months before he started shooting JFK.
Yeah, and also just that past summer, he also was in one of the biggest blockbusters that summer, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Yeah. Somehow that movie just keeps coming back again and again. I don't know. We'll see about doing an episode on that. But there are other
names too in the cast, not just Costner's, like Tommy Lee Jones. There's Kevin Bacon, Laurie Metcalf, Gary Oldman. Mm-hmm. There's Michael Rooker, Ed Asner, Jack Lemmon, as we mentioned, Spacek, Walter Matthau, Joe Pesci, Vincent D'Onofrio, John Candy, mm-hmm. Brian Doyle Murray. The list goes on and on.
Right. I mean, so it is. It was a formidable ensemble that Stone had assembled for this project. And the one thing that we haven't really talked about is a little of some of the inspiration for, at least the foundation for what the story of JFK the film would be. And I know that some of the genesis for what would become the script for the film was forged in 1987, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, there was a book actually that was written by a former New Orleans district attorney who is played in the film by Costner. His name is Jim Garrison. And he was a man who actually, in the mid-60s, as the film dramatized, he didn't believe, like other people, that Oswald was the sole perpetrator of the assassination, that there was a conspiracy involved. And he actually was the first person to sue and take a person to court that he believed was part of the conspiracy, Clay Shaw. And he was unsuccessful in the court, but he was still adamant that he believed there was a conspiracy, and he later wrote a couple books about it. The second book, though, was what gained Stone's attention. It was called On the Trail of the Assassins. And Stone recalled that when he read that book, he just found it like this gripping detective story, and he felt like there really was a story that he could make into a movie from that. Even though the credits also list a second book as being inspiration too, called Crossfire, The Plot That Killed Kennedy by Jim Mars.
Right. Well, and the thing is, when Garrison was working on the 87 book, if I'm not mistaken, that was also co-written by another author who, actually, it was Zachary Sklar, who was a journalist, and he approached Garrison to help him sort of tweak and rewrite the manuscript, as Sklar was sort of saying he wanted to turn the book from a certain thing that was a little more scholarly and dry to a, in his words, quote, detective story, a whydunit in the first person. And that's actually interesting because the very question of why is what fuels particularly the second half of Stone's film.
JFK. Oh. One man once died. Did you know that he could read all our minds? He was the U.S. Adam with Jack the wife. He was a hyper-charismatic telepathical knight. JFK.
So and they shot the film pretty... I mean, the thing that's really remarkable about JFK is that that shooting did begin in May of 1991, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe it was April. It was the spring of 91, and I believe they wrapped in August. So... Yeah. And then they released the film on the 20th of December, so one day before you and I were born.
Yeah, I'm kind of glad that, maybe it was probably for the best that we didn't go see that movie.
Right when or that our mother decided to go see it instead of going to the hospital.
That would have been very awkward. Yeah, the whole mythos of us being born in a movie theater and JFK would be playing in the cinema. But the thing is also we have to add that Stone was very busy this year because the same year he had worked on and released another historical film, which was The Doors. And that was, of course, about Jim Morrison with Val Kilmer in the lead role. And that had garnered its own share of controversy in terms of Stone's veracity to the truth. I know that some of Morrison's bandmates took issue with their portrayal in the film, but whatever misgivings they had about it, that didn't compare at all to the sort of firestorm that was caused by JFK.
Oh, yeah, no, and it was quite a firestorm. And there's that whole controversy that's still to this day of should this film be taken at face value? Should it be looked at as, like, a historical document? Even though the film was so popular and actually grossed over $200 million worldwide, and garnered several awards, as we said, that it did inspire Congress to pass the 1992 JFK Information Act. And later on, so it made them declassify even further records, which had not been disclosed in the Warren Commission and were fully disclosed in 1998. Though there were more documents that had yet to be declassified and were going to be in 2017, but then Donnie Trump decided to keep them classified and then said, oh, we'll declassify them in 2018. But then he postponed that to 2021.
Mm. And here we are in 2021, and I have a sneaky suspicion that those documents won't be declassified anytime soon. But yeah, so but Stone's JFK cost $40 million, $20 million of which I believe was initially put up by Warner Brothers. And then Stone, of course, when he was developing the film, it was always conceived to be an epic. He was originally even conceiving the film to be somewhere around the four-hour mark. And the film as it stands now, the director's cut, is just a little shy of 3.5 hours.
Yeah, almost as long as The Irishman. And he did say, actually, another film that he inspired, I think I want to mention, too, because he said it was a mix of, like, a documentary style with a big-name ensemble, was The Longest Day.
Mm.
Mm. You know, from the late 60s. So, yeah, so it's kind of like having a big epic with the, you know, high name caliber of a cast, and then but then you have the historical documentation going on.
Well, right, and the film is very much, it's fusing dramatization with real life footage as well, and it is a film that's very much about blurring the distinction between fiction and nonfiction, and that's certainly what got it in trouble with a lot of critics and journalists, you know, who were claiming that the film was doing a disservice to journalistic integrity. And right. Yeah, and it's still even today now, there's this whole question about, is the film, does it operate successfully as a piece of revelatory journalistic filmmaking, or is it sheer sensationalism? And for his part, Stone has stayed true to his allegations that in many respects the government may have had some sort of a hand in the assassination. Now, we aren't necessarily here to speculate about whether or not it was a government coup, if it was the mafia, or if Lee Harvey Oswald did act alone, but it just goes to show that I think that there is something about this particular case which continues to inspire endless speculation. I mean, and even if some of these documents are declassified in the future, I think that there's going to just continue to be speculation about what really happened that November day 58 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, like, the assassination is just, I think it's now become one of the greatest American mysteries of the second half of the 20th century, not of American history. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, there was actually a great movies review essay by Roger Ebert talking about this film, why he put it in there. And I think that actually was a good point. And that's sort of what I read at first before I saw the movie for the first time. And so that's kind of how I went into it going in, where Ebert wasn't looking at it as like a film that, you know, judging it on terms of its authenticity, but like because of how he felt it channeled the distrust and anger that Americans at the time felt against their government and from the fallout. And especially because a lot of people had optimism, which what could things have been better had Kennedy lived? We don't know. You know, who can say? Mm-hmm. But there was all fallout following his assassination. And honestly, because now you have all this distrust and paranoia against the government, and for some valid reasons, so we have to be honest and frank. And another reason why I wanted to talk about this film was because I feel like the gamut of distrust and conspiracy theories has only...
You mean the glut of conspiracy?
Yeah, the glut. Yeah, that's a good word. The glut of conspiracy theories has only increased in the 30 years since it's come out, and has, I think, affected more, even more so, like, the way we go about our lives.
And the way that we also choose or do not choose to trust our government. Mm-hmm. But... yeah, this is not going to be a conspiracy theory podcast episode. We're not going to kind of break down all of the myriad conspiracy theories about JFK, because other podcast episodes exist of that, and I think that plenty of attention has been paid to that. I think what our job is to look at is the film itself, and about its success or failure as a piece of historical fiction. And because there's always this very tricky question about historical films and about what they're trying to emulate in terms of the milieu that they are depicting on screen. Because, of course, every time any filmmaker makes a historical film, it's what they're really doing is making a film about the present moment and obliquely commenting on the present through the past. I mean, we were talking earlier this year about Edward Yang's A Brighter Summer Day, and that film is very much attempting to take stock of the trauma of the White Terror and life under military rule from Chiang Kai-shek, in the wake of the fall of the Kuomintang's rule over Taiwan. And so JFK is very much about also, it's focusing on the legacy of this assassination once the Cold War has ended. Because Kennedy's, so much of his foreign policy was colored by the Cold War. And this, from Vietnam to, of course, his most notorious scandal, the Bay of Pigs.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I guess moving into sort of the film itself, because there's a lot to talk about with this film. Because this was my first time watching it. I hadn't seen the film before we decided to do this podcast episode. And I, truth be told, I've only seen bits. Oh, I've seen a few of Oliver Stone's films. And he has, and he's done quite a bit. And again, this was a film that marked a transition in terms of him focusing on particular historical incidences. Like, for example, we're seeing something like World Trade Center, which came out in 2006,
yes,
if I remember correctly. It's been a while now, but essentially, it's the thing that's really interesting about JFK as a film is how it attempts to convey this rapid escalation of facts, in air quotes, I suppose, these revelations which are uncovered gradually throughout the film. And, of course, how that runs in tandem with history unfolding. And there is something on a very visceral level. It is, of course, evocative of, we were talking a little bit earlier about Costa Gavras and his form of political filmmaking with Z, but there's something about it that, in terms of the cross-cutting of the film's editing structure, that it harkens, it's like a hyper-stylized version of the foundation of cross-cutting that D.W. Griffith set in place with something like Birth of a Nation. And that's a problematic comparison. I'm not saying that JFK is as overtly racist as Birth of a Nation, but we will get into that at some point. But there is something about that, that the film grammar that Stone is utilizing, it's at one point it was very striking and very vivid and propulsive for that period. And yet at the same time, it was still operating, I think, in a very familiar vocabulary, at least vocabulary indigenous to the cinema.
Yes, I agree with you. I mean, like, I like the Griffith comparison you made, but even, like, in between, you had other films which kind of, you could also argue were precursors to JFK. Like, the film I was thinking of, and it, I was reminded of, actually, when I saw this after JFK, was Orson Welles' F for Fake.
No, that's a great point to make as well, because, yeah, F for Fake is all about, like, the inherent, the dubiousness of the image, of the photographic image. And, of course, Welles is, like, very frank about that he's making a film about fakery and fraud and trickery, which is in about, but that's also like very inherent to the medium of film itself, because on the one hand you have theorists who like Bazin who were arguing for cinema as a realization of photography's capacity to embalm time and reality for realism, really. And then on the other hand you had these filmmakers like Méliès who from the beginning utilized cinema as a medium for capturing the fantastical, for conveying the fantastical. And as you know, we're now 120 odd years into cinema's history, those lines, those distinctions between realism and the fabulous impulses of cinema have gradually blurred. And I think that they blur quite a bit in JFK. I don't know how you feel, if you agree with that.
Oh yeah, I believe so, absolutely. And even when I saw it the first time, I thought it was very interesting for me anyways. And yeah, this was before, like, I had, you know, like, I had, like I said before, I'd seen F for Fake. And I think also kind of understanding and really, I think, wrapping my head around the sort of the chronology of, like, the way editing is applied into cinema, even though I've been aware of things like the Eisensteinian theory and Griffith, as you said. But
oh, yeah, with montage. And I mean, and one could argue as well that montage is critical to the editing structure of JFK.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can definitely see why this film won an Oscar for its editing, because the editing is so crucial, I think, to the tempo, to the tone that I think Stone is trying to convey in this film. Because with it, like, you know, even though he'd do things like slow down time, for example, during a dramatic moment, he had done that too in Born on the 4th of July, but like with the kind of like this, for lack of a better term, the way he, like, all of a sudden would flash the imagery and, like, maybe flash cut to a black and white image or real archive footage or dramatization.
Or even, like, something that I think is more overtly Eisensteinian is the moment early in the film when Jim Garrison and his colleagues are watching the live television broadcast of what would be Lee Harvey Oswald's execution from Jack Ruby. And the way that that whole sequence is edited these very rapid cuts between the broadcast and the reactions of the staff in alarm as they rise up in their harried, like, it is a physically violent sensation, you know, as if the violence that's being done to Oswald is being transposed onto the psyche of the American people.
Yeah, it is kind of assaulting on the American people in a way similar to the famous steppe scene of Battleship Potemkin.
Well, the whole massacre scene in the Odessa steppes, absolutely.
And so, yeah, I agree with you, but what I found interesting when seeing it for the first time, and what I think is kind of like, some could argue is the greatest strength of this movie, is the momentum it carries, like tries to grab your attention of like, with all this information and detail, some of which is true, like about Operation Mongoose, which was a real covert CIA operation to try to undermine Castro's leadership in Cuba and to help overthrow him. Mm-hmm. And it failed in misery. But then you have all these other information and details that the film presents, and it kind of, I think as you're watching it, it does come at you so quickly that you do sort of get lost in it, but I feel like it works to the film's advantage because you kind of, I think you feel like you're with the garrison where you kind of feel overwhelmed and you're like swimming in all like this whirlpool of information, like how deep this goes and how it's interconnected. Everything's interconnected with each other.
Well, and that's, I think it's a testament to the film's craft that it does give you the sense that you are slowly, gradually getting deeper and deeper into this morass of information and conspiracy. And it is overwhelming. And at the same time, I can see how that would also be a chief site of criticism for the film, of that it is so actively working to manipulate you into feeling that sense of just you're so overwhelmed by what you're watching that then you have to stop and think about it and think like, well, wait a minute, are these arguments actually holding water? Are these held up by very tenuous threads? And I think that there's something to be said about the way that the film tries to give a lot of stock to these very tenuous threads to feed into these arguments, these conspiracy theories that it's positing forth. And I don't mind that so much as I do mind a couple of moments where Stone is very overtly trying to antagonize particular figures. You were referencing Clay Shaw earlier, who was the major figure Garrison went after during the trial and the conviction after the Zapruder film was made to the available to the public. But he's played by Tommy Lee Jones in this film. And Jones was nominated for an Oscar for the film. And Jones he's certainly a very talented performer. He's been in a lot of films. He's done a lot of great work in a lot of great films. And the way that he plays this character, I think, of course, like I think he has a certain emotional intelligence in terms of expressing the refined haughtiness of a man who we learn is a closeted homosexual. I mean, he's a very cultured man, but of course, behind closed doors, he's having these weird bacchanalia and orgies with other guests, including Kevin Bacon's character, who's a convict, who first leads them on the trail of Shaw.
And also with David Ferry, played by Joe Pesci.
Yes, yeah, who was certainly an interesting character in terms of his own his look, which they do capture fairly accurately in the film. But the thing about the character of Shaw, or rather I should say the portrayal of Shaw in the film, is that the film does court controversy, at least from a modern audience's standpoint. There's something very simplistic about the way that the film portrays, or it links Shaw's homosexuality to a sense of abnormality. For example, there's a whole sequence where, as I was sort of referencing earlier, we see kind of this orgy of sorts where he and several other compatriots are in his ornate mansion in Louisiana, and they are engaged in fleetingly glimpsed sexual activities. And there's a moment where, even as they're sort of acting out these sexual fantasies, there's the sound effect of a bull's roar, you know, over the soundtrack, and it's very distracting. And it's and I mean, I can't say it's too much of a surprise that Oliver Stone is not the most nuanced filmmaker when it comes to homosexual relationships, because I was reminded immediately of Alexander, which is one of the few Stone movies I've seen, and which I absolutely despise.
I've seen parts of Alexander, and I hate it too, but I know I know it has a cult audience, but you're not going to find lovers here.
Not on this program, I'm afraid not. But you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Like, there's something about the portrayal of Shaw in this film. And about, and even there's a moment where Garrison's wife criticizes him for going after Shaw. She says, like, you're only targeting him because he's a gay man. And then Garrison's like, no, that's not it. And what the film is kind of... what Stone is sort of doing in some ways is, like, he's trying to sort of dispel this notion of, like, people who utilize their status as an outsider to, like, cover up the way that they're complicit within the system. And that's all well and good. But at the same time, like, his understanding of the nuances of codifying as straight while being a gay person in the 60s, it's reduced to some very simplistic dramatic beats.
I'd recently published a review for Silence of the Lambs, you know, and I felt like doing, because that's also a culturally significant film that came from America the same year.
And it beat JFK for the Best Picture Oscar.
It sure did, to a lot of people's surprise. But, you know, as much problems as I had with, as a lot of people had, and justifiably so, with the character of James Gunn, a.k.a. Buffalo Bill, that character and Demme's portrayal, you know, direction of that is nuanced compared to Oliver Stone. I mean, let's face it, yeah. I mean, to put it in frank terms, Oliver Stone's as subtle as a jackhammer, and which can work and also to his advantage, but also his disadvantage severely.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like even when that bull sound effect came on, I remember when I saw it the first time, even I kind of was like, I didn't know whether to laugh at that honestly or not. You know, yeah. It was so over the top. It did feel reductive, and it just felt like it was almost a parody, a lampoon.
And well, it's an equation of homosexuality to bestiality, and that has nothing to do with the case of JFK's murder at all.
I mean, like, yeah, when you look at these gay characters, and even Kevin Bacon, you know, when he, like, he's portrayed as a guy who's also racist, you know, he says the N-word, and at the end of the interview, he kind of offers some sex to Costner's Garrison once he gets out of prison. So,
yeah, he solicits him for sexuality. And again, like, there's something to be said about, like, on the one hand, of course, like, that's not to say that, oh, gay people can't be racist. And there were, you know, I mean, to say otherwise would be very reductive and harmful in terms of trying to actually talk about the complexities and contradictions of identification, of how people identify.
It would be like in Silence of the Lambs when Jodie Foster's clearly claims transsexuals are very passive. Right. And that's why Buffalo Bill's not technically a transsexual.
No, but my point being that, my point was going to be that just like, I think that the way that the film handles, you know, sort of the contradiction of queerness with racism, it's not handled very well. It's very bluntly, it's just thrown out there as an incidental detail just to make us look at characters like Willie O'Keefe as something, as an antagonist, as a repugnant figure to revile, as somebody who was, like, in some ways he's antithetical to what the promise of JFK was. And JFK, of course, is not a character in this film. JFK is more of a symbolic figure. He's a MacGuffin that fuels the plot, and he's a symbolic stand-in for a lot of this, these potential musings about what would America have been like had he lived? Would we have gotten out of Vietnam? Would we have continued to, you know, build upon some of the legislation about, particularly the Civil Rights Act that was passed during his presidency, or was at least
it was passed by President Johnson.
I should say, but it was certainly introduced in his presidency, and you know, his brother Bobby's, the district attorney was, or the attorney general, I should say, was instrumental in helping to get that, to at least think about desegregation, you know, in terms of focusing as making that a national priority, a priority for national security, because of course that was a political tactic to ideologically combat the Soviet Union. But that being all said, the way that Stone also is tapping into that is very simplistic in regards to his presence of characters of color, which is in this film almost non-existent. There aren't any characters. What they are stand-ins. And what they do is, for example, there's a moment where Jim Garrison goes to the Eternal Flame in Washington, D.C., and you see a black father and his son standing right by him, and the father's staring at the son. We don't really hear anything. He's staring at the fire, and he's pointing it out to his son, and we don't really hear any dialogue, and there's no dialogue to speak of, but we just understand that they're paying homage to this great emancipator of sorts. And that's the extent to which whenever we see any black characters in the film, except for MLK, who gets assassinated.
Well, and also, like, the Garrison family also have a maid who has, like, a couple of lines, like, early on in the film when they see the news of the assassination, and she just says, like, sadly, oh, he would have done a lot of great changes for us. But she's never really established as a character. She's just, as you put it, a walking stand-in with a couple of lines.
Exactly, exactly. And but it's also very peculiar about the way that the film also narrativizes the succession of assassinations. Because as we talked about earlier, that the 60s were, as a decade, was characterized in the United States by a string of political assassinations. And the killings of Martin Luther King Jr. and Bobby Kennedy both figure as important dramatic moments in the narrative of JFK, the film. Curiously, Malcolm X's assassination is completely omitted in the film, even though he does appear in the film's opening montage. And that, to me, is also... It's a willful omission of another famous historical figure's death, simply because it doesn't fit the narrative that Stone is attempting to craft in terms of this historical political trajectory that he's laying out for his audience. And that's disingenuous, I feel.
And it's ironic, too. I mean, considering that another director who's also been criticized for going over the top, and that how that could be a strength and weakness of his, Spike Lee, how he would end up making a biopic about Malcolm X the following year.
Yeah, and if I have to be truthfully honest, I think that Malcolm X as a historical film is in many ways much more satisfying than JFK, because what that film does is it is a stirring and powerful testament to the life and work of Malcolm X in a way that really actively dismantled a lot of the wrongheaded or incorrect assumptions about who he really was and what he stood for politically and socially in this country. And yet, at the same time, it presents his contradictions and his shortcomings and his weaknesses. It humanizes him.
Yeah, this JFK doesn't really humanize Kennedy. It maintains that messiah figure which is still prevalent around him to this day, 58 years after his death.
And there's the moment at the end of the film where Garrison goes on to a long, long, long monologue about...
It gives the psychologist from Psycho a run for his money.
But he's essentially talking about... He's giving his closing arguments for the jury in this trial. And he's laying out all of his arguments, and he's going into this very long speech about the necessity for truth. And he urges the jury to not forget their king. And that fits into the whole kind of narrative of linking Camelot with the Kennedys and the loss of Camelot and the loss of this king. And of course that's a resonant narrative. It's an easy narrative. It's an alluring one, but there's also something in them that I think is, for a filmmaker who has in many respects actively criticized American imperialism, there's something also fundamentally conservative about the ending of JFK in terms of its closing notes that for me makes it seem like it's a film which could be adopted wholesale by the right wing in this country today. I mean, when you're thinking about the preservation of the family unit with the closing shot of the film, and even the way that the film valorizes a president as a king, it is nominally for the uncovering of truth as a form of preserving our democracy, and yet at the same time it's contradicting itself with the rhetoric that it's utilizing.
Well, yeah, I'm glad you raised it up, because yeah, there's the subplot too about Garrison's investigations and his obsession over it putting a strain on his family, and particularly his wife. And that's also a subplot that I never cared for, it not even when I saw it the first time, because I do feel it's honestly very simplistic, and it's a disservice even to Sissy Spacek, who's a really good actor,
and she gives a fine performance in the film.
Yeah, she drives what she can,
but it's one of those things that I will say, like, every time, like, we do cut back to the Garrison household and we see more, and some of the editing in that is so didactic in terms of,
oh, yeah,
you know the way that the film would cut from like one, like the son, I believe, of Garrison asking like, oh, is daddy, you know, gonna come home, and then we just cut to like the baby daughter like just crying. It's like, we get it.
Again, Stone's not known for his subtlety.
No, but at least, like, you know, but with somebody like Lee, with Spike Lee, like, on an interpersonal dynamic, you know, in a film like Malcolm X, that taps into more nuance than the interpersonal dynamics which exist in JFK's film. And that's, for me, what makes it a weaker film than something like Malcolm X. And it's what, for me, I find also very frustrating as a film, as an ideological articulation from Stone. Because I think that there is... he is actively working to uncover a lot of contentious feelings, and I don't think that there should be any answers, because of how could there be any answers to this really traumatic moment in our nation and our country. And I think it's always worth it for any filmmaker, for any person, to actively work towards uncovering the truth. But I think it's a mistake as well when you're working to uncover the truth and you treat your audience like children.
Yeah, that never works. And we've seen filmmakers like before and after Stone who would do that. And I think that always kind of puts us at odds with them. Like Adam McKay, I think, is very guilty of doing that as well. Mm-hmm. Aaron Sorkin is kind of guilty of that too.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's really great you brought up the Adam McKay comparison, because I do think, like, without Oliver Stone, we wouldn't have Adam McKay's sort of film.
And now he's got a new Netflix movie coming out.
Yeah, right. Exactly. But, like, and of course, you know, the Vice or, you know,
The Big Short.
The Big Short is, yeah, I was like, whoa, it's The Big Sick? No. But The Big Sick's a better movie than either of those. But the point being that, you know, even though they're nominally comedies, they are still operating in the same sort of vernacular, or the same sort of film grammar that Oliver Stone was, I would argue, he was laying out with something like JFK. But they take it more to the extreme of didacticism in a manner that treats the audience like children who need to be educated. It's a pedagogical vantage point, and there's nothing wrong with having a film that's pedagogical in nature, but if you start to sort of condescend to your audience, or if you're simply preaching to the choir, there's something very dangerous about the efficacy of your message actually reaching the people you're intending it to reach.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on that. And I think that's something to consider, like, not just for dramatic and fiction directors, but also for documentary directors, too. We've seen many documentaries where they have great messages, but they kind of get, they're undermined by the execution, you know, in that way, that the condescending execution.
It's so great that we're having this conversation today, because I just, earlier today, I had a conversation with a colleague and a friend of mine who's a film programmer, and she does a lot of work in programming films that blur that line between truth and reality. And she is very much in the camp that, and she was talking a lot about didacticism as well, and about the importance of not treating your audience in a didactic way when you're making films that are about truth. And because you don't want to betray the trust of your audience, you don't want to betray the trust of, as a filmmaker, you don't want to betray the trust of your subjects as well. You want to ensure that there is this, you know, this consent, that this contract that exists, you know.
I mean, like, that's why it's interesting, like, you know, of course Jean-Luc Godard famously described film as truth in 24 frames a second.
But and every cut being a lie.
Yeah. But, and then you have, like, the movies, like, even a film like Nanook the North would describe itself as a documentary, mm-hmm. but it was infamous for, like, just staging the sets. And
right, right. And that's what she was talking about, too. You know, like, from the very early stages of documentary, that was always suspect, you know, because and Flaherty called them actuality films. And so there's that, you know, it's such a charged term as well, in terms of how we relate to, especially something which exists outside of the realm of our everyday, you know, and the ideological baggage that carries, it's intrinsic to cinema.
So I wanted to wrap this up by asking you, of course, the question we always ask during these episodes is, would you recommend this film?
You know what, I mean, I think, here's the thing about JFK, is that I think it's a film that, it's an important film for many reasons, because of what it was accomplishing in terms of speaking to a very significant event in history for Americans, and to try to map that out into a broader map of geopolitics and the relationship between Kennedy's death and the way that that impacted American foreign policy over the successive decade. And of course, that the film is at the very opening, the very first thing that we hear in the film is Dwight Eisenhower's speech about the military-industrial complex. And there's, of course, something to be said for the relevance of not ceding power to a very small body of people. And that's been relevant in America for many, many decades, and it continues to be relevant now. I think that the caveat that I have about this film is that it poses these questions, but does so in a way that could very easily be misconstrued by the very people that I think Stone is purportedly wary of or warning us of. And in that respect, I think JFK is a technical feat that still has enough problems that I would say it requires a great deal of conversation to happen in terms of actually processing it and distinguishing the ideological aims that it is striving for with the truth and reality and of who has power in this country and of how power manifests in complicated ways.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm in agreement with you. I think I would recommend the film to people, even though I think it's deeply flawed, deeply, but it's still an important film for people to see because of the reasons I said, where I do feel like it kind of can reflect and channels that anger and frustration. I think that's because I think Stone's anger and frustrations against the government following Vietnam and such, I think, whereas I could, you know, a lot of Americans could connect with that. And even at the time, even as Stone pointed out, 75% of Americans did not believe in the Warren Commission. Mm-hmm. So I think that's important to it's like capturing almost a snapshot in time of like people's feelings and sentiments, even though, of course, new information had come to light since the film's release. But I do think it is, as you said, I think because of the way it executes the material, people should keep in mind of how problematic it could be and benefiting, because as we've seen, you know, we also have people on both sides, you know, left wing and right wing, passing conspiracy theories that are could be actually more harmful than beneficial to the welfare of Americans. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just something to really keep in mind, and I think it is troubling and potentially dangerous, but not for the reasons I think people accused it of being upon its release 30 years ago.
It's a film that's very much about truth and about the power truth has, depending upon who wields it. And it's a lesson that I think can be it has to be applied, of course, to the U.S. government. And I think it also equally applies to someone like Oliver Stone.
I agree.
Yeah, so, I mean, I in terms of 1991 films, I would say if you're going to watch a big ensemble piece, you should prioritize A Brighter Summer Day.
I agree.
But if you're curious, it's worth checking out. And, you know, I mean, I think that it's really interesting that we're having this conversation now, Alex, about truth and actuality and about the relationship a filmmaker has with whatever milieu they're operating within, because it actually feeds into my recommendation of the week.
Oh?
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually it's quite a leap from something like JFK in terms of it's a relatively recent film. It premiered at the Venice Film Festival in 2019, but it didn't actually get a release here in the States until this past spring. And it is a film called This Is Not a Burial, It's a Resurrection. And it's by Lemohang Jeremiah Mosese, who was born in Lesotho. He's a filmmaker, though, who now lives in Berlin, and he's made a lot of moving art installation videos and pieces in Berlin. And he's made some experimental essay films as well. And this has been called something of a his most conventional film, I suppose, which is not to say that it is a conventional film. I mean, essentially the story, from on paper, it sounds pretty easy to put together. It's about this older woman, and she is played by the actress Mary Twala, who had been in quite a number of films for many, many decades before she passed away in 2020. And it's about her in this small village called Nazaretha, which is, of course, named after Nazareth, and about the village and this construction project, which is jeopardizing the village, of this new dam, which will flood the entire village. It will flood out the cemetery where many people who have lived in the village, generations of people have been buried. And it's about this older woman who is trying to resist the development of this new dam. And so, yeah, on paper, that all sounds like a fairly conventional movie of Lifetime movie of the week inspirational story. But Mosese, right from the beginning, his first two shots of the film give you an indication that what you're about to watch is certainly nothing that, even if you have some sort of passing familiarity with other films from African countries, it's not adhering strictly to realism in any capacity. The first shot, for example, is this very stylized, rapid, slow motion shot of a man attacking a horse with a spear, as strings scream on the soundtrack. And the second shot is a several-minute tracking shot through a derelict club, where then we track in upon the narrator of the film, who will be telling us this story. Is this narrator someone from the past? Is it someone from the future? Are they a ghost? Are all of these men in this club ghosts of this village? The film never tells us. And that interesting ambiguity extends outwards throughout the film's myriad motifs, particularly of the relationship between the villagers and their village, with these multiple shots, gorgeous shots, of emphasizing the negative space above their heads of the sky. This vast expanse of blue sky with white clouds hovering over these mountainous terrains and these valleys that they traverse through. And so what the film is about is, it's about a relationship. It's about a series of relationships, I should say, between the people between the land, people between their past, and also between people and their culture. And the film has a very nuanced approach towards the question of the relationship of people to Christianity in this small village. And Mosese has himself been very adamantly critical about Christianity and its influence on African culture. And, of course, why wouldn't he? It is a colonial instrument. And the film is certainly taking that into account, but it's also attempting to repurpose some biblical iconography, the question of a flood, the question of resurrection. It's reconfiguring this Christian iconography into a fiercely ferocious statement of resistance, but without any form of didacticism or proselytizing. And add on to that, it's just an extremely gorgeous film to watch on a big screen, or on any screen, I should say. It makes it a transfixing, hypnotic, but very probing and very stimulating film to watch. It's for people in the United States. It is currently streaming on the Criterion Channel, but for any of our listeners who are out in the United Kingdom, it will actually be getting a very rare theatrical screening on, I believe, December the 10th at the Close Up Film Center in Shoreditch in London. It's absolutely worth checking out, and certainly one of my favorite films of the year that's gotten a theatrical release here in the United States. I was very much taken by this impressive fiction film. It's fantastic.
You know, I remember hearing about this movie last year because it was submitted by Lesotho, I believe, for the Oscar for Best International Film, but did not get ultimately nominated. And I was wanting to like seek out and see all these different kinds of like international film submissions from various countries, because it's easy to like, you see, of course, like the crowd pleasers that would eventually get nominated and win, like Another Round from Denmark. But I love it when you can catch those kinds of films, like either from like a country that, especially since we've discussed before about feeling of African cinema kind of being overlooked by a lot of people. And I think that you get these sort of stories that are told in these wholly unique ways. And I think it is like finding some sort of special treasure nuggets like that. Or even like from Portugal, I think about Vitalina Varela.
Well, I mean, and yeah, it's Pedro Costa is also one of those filmmakers who is, he, I think, the way that he interacts as well with real figures and that sort of communication he has with his real subjects, like that's something that I think is it's a powerful testament to the privilege filmmakers have in sampling the truth in terms of telling a story, but not exploiting the truth.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, so I've been meaning to see this film for a while, and I'm so glad that it's finally at least able to gain access in the United States. And I hope that, yeah, that our English listeners will be able to catch it very soon.
It's certainly worth catching. I mean, especially, you know, I love the Close Up Film Center. It's a wonderful, wonderful independent venue. It's kind of like the Trilon here in Minneapolis, you know, except that they have an actual DVD library and a book library of film stuff. And
that's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah, I've definitely got to take you there sometime.
But my recommendation is, it's actually from a filmmaker who I have a special tie to, because he was one of the first international filmmakers I was introduced to when I went to take cinema courses back at community college over 10 years ago. And his name is one that a lot of Finnish directors and Finnish viewers may be familiar with. His name is Aki Kaurismäki. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know him, he's a director he's been compared to a lot of directors from like a lot of countries, like from Jean-Pierre Melville to Jim Jarmusch to Ozu, and to Wes Anderson. And he has this peculiar kind of style in which he likes to focus on a lot of people who have these like sullen, sad faces. And the lines of dialogue they speak, even as simple as they may sound, as Roger Ebert one time put it, they speak them like they're speaking eternal truths. And I wanted to mention a film which is one of his most notable features, and actually was the first and so far only Finnish film to receive an Oscar nomination for the International Film category, though Compartment Number 6 might get nominated. We'll see. And this film, though, I'm referring to is the 2002 feature The Man Without a Past. And the story also sounds like something that could... It's a simple, straightforward story. It's about a man who we don't know his name for a good majority of the film. In fact, the credits, he's listed as the letter M, actually.
All right. And well, it's interesting that you bring. We forgot to mention this in JFK. Donald Sutherland plays a guy named X. So, like, you know, there's that lettered connection between the films.
Yeah, but he's no secret agent or anything, or at least he doesn't think so. We don't know because it opens with him just going to Helsinki, you know, for a job offer. And he sort of like he arrives at the station. It's the middle of the night. And he just stops to sit at a park bench for a little rest. And then he all of a sudden gets jumped on by these hooligans who mug and beat the everlasting life out of him, like to a pulp. And so he suffers severe head concussions and injuries. He's taken to a hospital. He flatlines for a sec, so it looks like he's gone. But then he rises up, so there's a resurrection, you could say, of sorts. Mm-hmm. And he kind of stumbles, staggers out of the hospital, and he's found unconscious near a stream where a couple find him, and they take him into their little into their home, which is like a rundown shack. And as he regains strength and heals from his wounds, he explains that he has no memory of who he is. He has no identification on him since all that stuff was taken off him. So he kind of wanders around this little town, which is full of a bunch of homeless people, and he finds a place for himself, which is kind of like looks like those giant trailer carts or something. And it's like the landlord is this sort of cop guy who tries to act tough, and he tells him, like, you know, you follow the rules and you pay the rent, or else I'm going to sick my dog on you, Hannibal, who's like this ferocious dog. Though the first time you see this dog, he looks anything but the epitome of ferocious. In fact, he may not even be a he. But Emma learns to make friends with some other people, and he even gains a love interest in a woman who works as part of the Salvation Army. And he kind of helps with them, like, with their musical performances, kind of add a little jazz to it based on his affinity and love for jazz music. But then eventually, his past does catch up with them, and he comes to grips and terms with it, but I won't say how. And what I think what this film reflects, I mean, like, even when I describe the pitch, it sounds like it could be a Frank Capra sort of feature, or some sort of, like, saccharine or cheesy kind of film.
It's like The Majestic.
But it's anything but The Majestic. And what I like about Kaurismäki is how he underplays it so much. I mean, kind of like Wes Anderson, like I said, the way he kind of, like, his characters have an almost deadpan delivery of the dialogue. Sometimes then the humor comes off as very dry, but sometimes you just kind of laugh at it. Like I said, the introduction of the dog Hannibal, who, of course, then him immediately befriends. And, like, even there's a shot of, like, him sleeping on his cot and Hannibal sleeping with him.
Mm-hmm. It's very Tati-esque also.
Yes, yeah, it is a bit Tati-esque. I mean, there's a lot of the components that he kind of makes, but he does in his own way that is unique. And there's something kind of sweet in seeing this communal support for each other, and, like, the way he changes people's lives, but they also kind of, like, the way they support or help and look out for him. And even the romance he has with the Salvation Army lady, who's played by Kati Otinen, who actually won a Best Actress Prize at Cannes for the film, along with receiving prizes for the Grand Jury Prize, as well as the Economical Prize and the Palm Dog. But I think there is a sweetness to it that, even though it's very dry, but it's never forced, and that's what I enjoy about him. It's like sometimes, you know, characters may have a sullen look on them, but there can be a sunny sort of appearance to the whole aesthetic that feels reminiscent of Ozu's Good Morning. And if you're curious, it may be your cup of tea. I think you might like it. I think it's a charming and enjoyable little film.
Well, I mean, I have a confession to make, and it's that Kaurismäki is one of those filmmakers I've heard about for many, many years now, and yet I have still not seen a single film of his. And it's one of those things that's so strange because, you know, the way that you're describing his aesthetic and his style, it sounds exactly like something that would be up my alley.
Oh, absolutely. I think you would enjoy him quite a bit.
And you've seen a few more of his work than I have. And so I just wanted to kind of ask you, like, how does this film compare to something like Le Havre or some of his... I'm not sure if you've seen any of the Leningrad Cowboys films.
No, I don't think so. I've only seen four of his. I saw Le Havre, which I saw actually when it first came out 10 years ago, and I haven't seen it since. But I also saw... Actually, the first film I was introduced to his, it was actually around that time when Le Havre was coming out, and I saw Shadows in Paradise. That was my introduction to him. And I've also seen Lights in the Dusk, which is kind of more like him doing his take on the film noir. But in terms of having a favorite, so some of them I haven't seen in a while, but like...
No, but like, how does this one differ from some of the other Kaurismäki films that you've seen? Like, how does it stand out?
Well, I think it's lighter than something like Dusk. But I also think that maybe... the aesthetic isn't as bright or sunny looking as, say, Le Havre, but I think that it's kind of like some, actually kind of, I guess it is a little like Shadows in Paradise, because of how it also is kind of like a love story about these two solitary figures who kind of find each other, And also, they don't have a lot of money between themselves, but they kind of just find themselves, and they're able to find love. And how there's this quiet sweetness to it. And I think that quiet sweetness it permeates throughout this movie, and I think it's one of its great strengths. And I do think it's probably one of his better films that he's made. Again, I would love to see some of his other films. And I think he's also a guy who you like, not just as a director, but just as somebody who's very politically active, because he has many times, like even when A Man Without a Past got nominated, he protested the Oscars 2002 gala in, you know, over protests of George W. Bush's foreign policies. Mm-hmm. And then he withdrew a Finland submission of his follow-up feature Dusk for the same exact reasons. Mm-hmm. And he actually was one of the many people to support the United Kingdom campaign of Jeremy Corbyn.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, but it's... I mean, I definitely need to check out more of Karasmaki's work because, yeah, I think any filmmaker who's certainly operating in a vein of deadpan humor whilst also having a lot of sympathy for the working class. And, like, I know in the film, like, Le Havre, it's also a lot of sympathy for migrants.
Yes.
Who are exploited economically. It makes his work beguiling and resonant for I think contemporary cinema. But it's interesting that he's also emerged from the 90s, you know, it seems like aesthetically he's channeling a lot of an older aesthetic to talk about contemporary issues.
Yeah, specifically in his native country. But it is interesting how I think particularly Man Without a Past and Le Havre focus also through like a sort of, even though they're not ensemble pieces, but also really the emphasizing the strengths of like a community coming together and what a community can accomplish.
Absolutely. Well, great. That's a fantastic recommendation. I think we've had two really great recommendations and we've covered quite a lot of ground in terms of our film viewing. But yeah, this was an interesting episode, you know, because there's still so much that's unresolved about JFK and about, I mean, both the film and the figure and his assassination. If you have any curious notes to share about the film, we would love to hear them. Any conspiracy theories, you might want to find someplace else. But we, you know, I'm always curious to hear as well about Oliver Stone and if there's a particular film of his which you think might require a bit of reevaluation. Because, of course, he's a controversial filmmaker and he's a filmmaker who has had an important impact on American cinema. So I'm always keen to hear about new things that I should check out to expand my horizons. And
if you have any favorite Karasmaki features, or if you have other favorite like Finnish features, you know, we'd love to hear those, you know, because I feel bad. I haven't seen a lot of Finnish cinema personally. So I feel like that'd be a good check out. Or even like if you have a favorite like Mosesi feature.
Well, yeah, which is, from what I understand, a lot of his work has been art installations or experimental essay films, which is great that you can blend the forms together. And, and this has been an episode talking a lot about films which are blending together different aesthetic forms of filmmaking.
Yeah, and just like, yeah, and being very elastic, because that's one of the great beauties of cinema, is that it's an expansive, flexible form that can...
It's not rigidly fixed.
No. It isn't.
Well, this has been a very stimulating conversation, Alex. I'm really glad we could talk about this. And we will definitely be back after Thanksgiving to talk about probably having a couple more episodes about 1991. We have one more film-specific episode, and I think we'll have a wrap-up episode for the year to touch on several films we didn't get around to. But until that moment, as always, be well, stay safe, and continue watching great movies.
You take care. For your American listeners, who, if you decide to celebrate holiday or not, I wish you a happy Thanksgiving, or you know, just to have a good holiday. And just to remember, everyone, we are all in this together.